Thank you for joining us. This is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at Fisheries Pod. If you're the generous sort, you can support the podcast through Patreon. And if that isn't your thing, you can also purchase Fisheries Pod shirts, hoodies, stickers, face masks on the Teespring store. So check it out. My name is Anders Halvorsen, and our guest today is Sean Lewis. Sean is currently a fifth-year PhD candidate at UC Davis, working with Dr. Greg Pasternak. He's studying the effects of river flow rates on Chinook salmon migration. Sean got his BS in Aquatic and Fisheries Sciences from the University of Washington in 2011. After college, he worked in a USGS fish pathology lab for a year, and then got a job as a junior officer on board the NOAA ship Okeanos Explorer. He spent much of the next 2 years with NOAA at sea, sailing on 20 different missions and serving in various capacities. In 2014, Sean got a job with the National Marine Fisheries Service as an endangered species biologist in Sacramento. And after he finished that gig, he joined Dr. Pasternak's lab at UC Davis. Welcome to the podcast, Sean.
Thanks for having me.
So, Sean, tell us a little more about yourself. How did you get interested in fisheries?
Okay, yeah. So I think my story is pretty similar to a lot of other people in this field. I kind of grew up spending a lot of time outdoors. I'm from the Seattle area, and my grandmother lived on one of the islands in Puget Sound near the city. And so I would go over there all the time, and I did a lot of tide pooling. You know, got dirty, was touching every little critter that I could, turning rocks over and everything like that. And so, I don't know, I just have had a passion for aquatic and marine science since I can remember. And so, yeah, I guess I'm just one of those people that has been fortunate enough to carry that through into my career. And even today, I love what I do and feel very fortunate about that.
That's great. So you went to the University of Washington.
I did.
And did you know the whole time you were there that you wanted to do fisheries?
So I started my undergrad in 2007. And I remember, you know, when I was applying, I was interested in marine science. The University of Washington has a few different avenues to do that. They have a biology department. Where there's some folks there doing marine research. They have an oceanography department. And then there's the School of Aquatic and Fisheries Sciences, which is its own sort of standalone department. And so I remember surfing the web pages of those three departments and trying to figure out what I wanted to do. The fisheries program just kind of called to me. And then as I started taking specific fisheries classes, I got more familiar with the actual field of fisheries science and what's involved and types of research that people are doing out there. I kind of fell in love with it. I definitely, you know, going in out of high school, I didn't understand the differences between those fields. And so I kind of just, I don't want to say stumbled my way through my undergrad, but, you know, took it one step at a time and just kind of chose the path that was right for me at the time. And actually, some friends and I, we were kind of part of this group in the undergraduate program in the fisheries department where we were interested in marine invertebrates. And so that program is very, there's a lot of salmon research going on there. And so, other like sort of more fisheries focused research. And we thought we were really cool, doing research on marine invertebrates. So it was kind of a different thing. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, my career has come full circle and I'm studying salmon. So
back to the fish.
Kind of funny. Yeah. But it's great. It's great. Yeah.
Okay. So I want to hear about your time as an officer with NOAA on these ships. That sounds like it was a pretty exciting couple of years.
Definitely, yeah. So I was, I'll step back and explain what the NOAA Corps is because it's not very well known. So there are five armed service branches in the United States. There's the Army, Navy, Marines, Air Force, and Coast Guard. But there are two more services that make up the seven uniformed services. And so in addition to those five armed services, there is a Public Health Service Officer Corps and then the NOAA Corps. So the NOAA Corps traces its lineage all the way back a couple hundred years to when it was formerly the U.S. Coast and Geodetic Survey. So it was a group of surveyors and oceanographers that were tasked with charting the United States' waterways. And so a big reason why the NOAA in the form that the agency is today exists under the U.S. Department of Commerce is because of those roots where, you know, it was important for global trade and basically U.S. economic productivity, making sure those waterways were charted and we could import and export goods and things like that. So over the years, the agency has kind of shifted more into the scientific and research and environmental monitoring realm. But yeah, so that's kind of why it exists. And
how many ships do they have?
I think right now there are 16 operational commissioned vessels.
Okay.
So those are the big ships. And then on top of that, NOAA obviously has a much larger fleet of smaller boats and things like that. Yeah. So when I'm actually a kind of a rare legacy case. My aunt Angela was served in the NOAA Corps in the 80s and early 90s. And so I knew about it growing up and heard her sea stories and things. And so I was always interested in it. The application process is similar to a college application. You submit essays and letters of recommendation and things like that. And then once you get accepted, you go through basic officer training, which is integrated with the Coast Guard Officer Candidate School. Okay. So I shipped out to New London, Connecticut, and spent 4 months at the Coast Guard Academy. Did a lot of pretty serious training there. It started with a lot of like classic like military indoctrination, a lot of push-ups and getting yelled at and things like that, team building exercises, and then gradually moved into a lot of coursework on like ship handling, survival at sea, did a lot of like marine firefighting training, damage control, and then other sort of like leadership and operational training pertaining to like managing shipboard operations. And then during that whole basic training process, you get to submit a memo with your top three ship choices. And I did not list the Okeanos on my memo and ended up being assigned there, which ended up being really cool because it's the one fleet in, or sorry, the one ship in the NOAA fleet that is dedicated to ocean exploration instead of just, you know, mandated research and monitoring missions. So it was really cool.
So what does that mean, ocean exploration?
Yeah, so the Okeanos Explorer, they operate, or that ship operates all over the place. So it's done missions up and down the East Coast, Gulf of Mexico, West Coast, as far west as like Indonesia and the South Pacific. It was refit. It was formerly a Navy ocean surveillance ship. And the refit was completed in 2008. So it's been operating since then. And it has a lot of deep ocean sonar equipment. So it has a multi-beam sonar that's configured for deep ocean surveys. So it can basically generate super high resolution bathymetry of like seafloor features like canyons and seamounts and things like that. It has a sub-bottom profiler, which is the super low frequency instrument that pings the bottom of the ocean to measure like the density of the seafloor, basically. So there are marine geologists out there that are interested in that kind of data. And then it also has an ROV, which is the coolest thing. So a remote operated vehicle, which is totally dedicated to that ship. It's actually two vehicles that work in tandem. It's a super cool setup. I never got to pilot the ROV. They didn't trust me enough for that. But
you got to sit there and watch the video feed?
I did, yeah. So it took me about a year to get qualified to stand watch, meaning like drive the ship on my own. And so when we would do those ROV dives, we would be sitting up on the bridge or the wheelhouse and there was not much for us to do because we were out like way, you know, hundreds of miles offshore. And so, yeah, we would just have the ROV video feed up on the bridge and we'd be checking out the footage from, you know, up to a mile and a half or 2 miles below us.
No kidding.
That was pretty, so very cool.
Tell us about some of the coolest things you saw on that.
Yeah, so there was one species that was discovered while I was out there. It was a sea star. And what's cool about the Okeanos setup is that they have a telepresence capability. So they have this big dish that broadcasts the ROV, like the HD ROV video footage live to the internet. So anyone can stream it in real time. And if anyone's interested in that, just Google NOAA Okeanos Explorer, and the ship has its own website with information on all that stuff.
I'm going to do that right after we hang up.
Yeah, it's super cool. And so we would have basically like deep ocean biologists all over the world that were watching this footage, and sometimes they would phone in and tell the scientists on board what they were looking at. It was really cool. Yeah, we saw some, there's something called a lizard fish, which was really hard to describe. It's like, just Google that too, lizard fish. Okay. It's got this really weird mouth and it kind of looks like an alligator almost, but like other freaky things down there, it's like doesn't really have well-developed eyes and it's very eerie looking. That's probably my favorite organism that we saw, but we surveyed a lot of deep ocean coral reefs and things like that. So yeah, it was cool.
Okay. And you're also a scuba diver and you were a dive officer on, well, not, that would have been a different ship. So how many ships did you serve on?
Just the one. Yeah. Okay. So I managed the dive unit aboard the Okeanos. And so a lot of that was just maintaining equipment and keeping records of everything. But I, you know, we would do proficiency dives and things like that. Occasionally we would run over debris out in the ocean and it would get wrapped around the propellers. So we would have to do a ship hull dive and bring hacksaws down with us and cut things off of the props and things like that. We did one really cool dive where we replaced a piece of equipment called basically an acoustic instrument that communicates with the ROV vehicle system. And so we had to go down there with a bunch of tools on our belt and replace that. You know, obviously that thing was like many thousands of dollars. And it's like, you know, how many of these instruments exist in the world? It's not like we can just get a replacement if we drop it or something. So that was definitely a high stakes operation that was nerve-wracking in the moment, but then really satisfying once we completed the repair.
It sounds fantastic. So you did that for 2 years.
Yeah, I was stationed aboard the ship for 2 years, and then my next assignment was at the National Marine Fisheries Service office in Sacramento. So the NOAA Corps is a little weird. You rotate typically between sea and land-based assignments. Unless you're a pilot, then you just fly planes. But yeah, so I rotated off the ship in 2014. And at that time, I knew I wanted to get back into the fisheries world. And so I was looking at NOAA Corps assignments that were within, National Marine Fisheries Service offices. So I'll just call it NIMFS, National Marine Fisheries Service. So NIMFS is a part of NOAA. So NOAA is kind of this umbrella agency that includes the National Ocean Service. That's where all your tide charts and everything comes from. National Weather Service, everybody knows what that is. So, and a few others. And so those are all within NOAA. And so I knew I wanted to work for NIMFS and do something related to fish conservation. And so, yeah, the assignment in Sacramento ended up working out for me. So I did that for another 3 years. So I was active duty for a total of 5 years.
Okay. And did you miss being on board the ship?
I did. Those 2 years were so intense for me and made such an impression on me that I still have like dreams where I'm back on my ship. I would say like a third to a half of all my dreams involve like being on the ship somehow. Okay. So like, yeah, clearly that time in my life was just like really intense and just made an impression on my subconscious. So I mean, there were some really amazing times and there were some really stressful times. It was just, it was an adventure, you know?
That's neat. Okay. So with NIMFS, you were working on salmon again, correct?
That's right. Yeah. So NIMFS has a number of regulatory offices throughout the United States. So the office I was working at in Sacramento is part of the NIMFS West Coast region. So each office typically has jurisdiction over a number of marine or anadromous species. So I think most people listening to this are going to know what anadromy means, but it's, you know, fish that migrate between salt and freshwater as part of their life cycle. So those species are considered to be marine as well. And so a lot of what these regulatory offices do is carry out a lot of legal proceedings under the Federal Endangered Species Act. Mm-hmm. So here in California, in the Central Valley, we have a handful of fish populations that are listed under the Endangered Species Act. So we have spring run Chinook salmon, winter run Chinook salmon, Central Valley steelhead, and then a southern distinct population segment of green sturgeon. And so a lot of the sort of like regulatory and policy activity that happens under the Endangered Species Act has to do with Section 7, which is of the Act, which is all about biological consultations and issuing take. So this term take, some people might be familiar with. There's a definition. It's like shooting, hunting, trapping, wounding, killing, disturbing, a few other verbs in there. Basically, it's a way to sort of legally define activity that's going to negatively impact some listed species. And so if there's another agency or organization or someone that's undertaking some activity that's going to adversely impact an ESA listed species, they have to go through this consultation process. And so I was working on that while I was there for the most part. And then there are a few other legal frameworks that we were working with too, but that was kind of the main one. And
what were the primary sources of the take? What were the issues?
So there are a lot, and some that you might not think of. So for me, for a while there, I was the acting Caltrans liaison. So Caltrans is the California State Department of Transportation. They do a lot of infrastructure related projects, either, you know, building bridges, replacing bridges, building culverts, like all these different sort of infrastructure elements that occur in waterways containing listed species. So I consulted on a lot of those projects. Basically, they would send us a project proposal, and the onus is kind of on the project applicant to figure out like the types of damage and effects that's they're going to incur. And then we sort of go through a verification / negotiation process with them to basically get to a point where we can authorize take. And so in some cases, that take is greater in magnitude or not. And in some cases, the analysis to determine how much take is going to occur is more or less complex. And so the consultations can range from like something that can be accomplished in the course of a month to something that can take years. And so another project I worked on there was the California Water Fix, which is a pretty contentious infrastructure project that's still in the works in California to change the way that surface water is managed in the Central Valley and exported to areas in the southern part of the state. So I worked on that for the last year and a half that I was there. And that was a much larger project with, you know, more stakeholders involved, more political. Yeah, that was pretty intense.
I imagine that was a highly contentious project. Water is absolutely worth more than gold out there, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So that sort of morphed into what you're doing now.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the biological consultations I worked on was for a river restoration program on the Lower American River, which flows out of the Sierra Nevadas and basically through the city of Sacramento. It was a project that was funded by the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation. Well, it's still ongoing. It's a what we call a programmatic consultation that included a number of different projects. And so the three main restoration actions that were included as a part of that were side channel construction, and the new side channels were going to target different species life cycle stages for different sort of biological needs, as well as woody debris replacement to enhance habitat complexity for juvenile fish, and then gravel augmentation. And so this occurs in a lot of different places, basically below a dam. Well, what a dam does is it cuts off the natural sediment supply and sediment flux that is occurring in a river. And so downstream of a dam, you basically have a net loss of sediment as the riverbed erodes over time. And for salmonids, they require a pretty specific size of sediment particle, or basically a size of a rock in the river to build their nests, which are called reds, and lay eggs. And so you basically don't have successful salmon spawning if you don't have the right kind of gravel in the river. And so what's happening up and down the West Coast, at least in a lot of places, is, you know, material will get excavated adjacent to the river, and then they'll bring these big sorting machines to sort out gravel of the right size, and then they'll put that back in the river. And so that has to happen basically on a yearly basis in a lot of cases.
So they're actually excavating right next to the river and then sorting out the gravel and then putting that, dumping that in the river.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens to the place where they did all the excavating?
The place that gets excavated is, it's kind of variable. Yeah. But anyway, so the reason why I had to consult on that is because all those activities, you know, are going to have a net benefit, obviously, in the long run. It's a restoration program, but in the there are some short-term effects that we had to account for and some short-term take that we had to issue. And so I was working on the Endangered Species Act documentation for that. But as a part of that project, I got invited to all these planning meetings for the actual design processes for those restoration sites. And so I got exposed to a lot of different like engineering techniques and ways of like modeling habitat for fish and things like that that were used in the design and implementation of these projects. And I remember being in those meetings and being like, wow, this is really cool. Like, this is what I want to do. Especially one of the engineers that was contracted to work on this had done some habitat modeling where they were basically able to show that following a side channel construction project, they basically under a certain range of flows that the river was going to experience, they were able to create optimal spawning habitat in these places. And then later on, they did red surveys where they looked at the locations where salmon were building their reds. And those reds were occurring to a large extent in the places where they predicted the optimal habitat was going to be. And I was like, oh my God, this is really amazing. I had no idea you could do this type of habitat modeling. And
so that's what drew you to it, was the predictive ability and the modeling and the recreation of suitable habitat?
Yeah. It was all just really cool to me. And so a few of the scientists and engineers working on that restoration program were former grad students of my current advisor at Davis, Dr. Pasternak. So, you know, I started talking to them. I was like, hey, this is really cool. Like, how do I even go about getting into this sort of line of work? And they're like, oh, you need to talk to Greg Pasternak. And so when I reached out to him, when it was time to apply to grad school, I was able to drop all these names of people that he had worked with before. And it just, the pieces all fell into place.
Well, it sounds like you had a pretty good resume for it as well.
Yeah. My career has been pretty unorthodox, I would say. It's taken some twists and turns, but I've been exposed to a lot of different kinds of science in a lot of different places, worked with a lot of different people. So that helps for sure.
Yeah. Okay. So tell us about the research you're doing for your PhD.
Yeah. So right now I am basically looking into environmental drivers of migratory routing and straying behavior in adult Chinook in the Central Valley. So I'll start by defining a few terms. So in the salmon life cycle, basically, you know, salmon are born in a stream, they rear in the stream for a while, and then they migrate downstream, they go through smoltification, where they transition from freshwater to saltwater, travel out to the ocean, forage in the ocean for a while, get really big, and then come back to spawn. And so it's a really, really complex life cycle as far as like fish biology goes. And so there are a lot of things that need to be available to them to carry out that life cycle process successfully. One thing that salmon really rely on, and we've understood this for decades now, is their sense of smell. So using olfactory navigation cues to carry out the outmigration as juveniles, as well as the upstream migration as adults. And so typically, it kind of depends on the species and the location, but it looks like about 90% of a given Pacific salmon population will successfully migrate back to their natal stream as adults. And then there will be a roughly 10% or so that will do what's called straying. And so straying just means an adult salmon has returned to some other location to try to spawn.
And this is your estimate under sort of undisturbed natural conditions?
Yeah. There's some literature out there that suggests that. Okay. And so I don't think enough work has been done on like every single species of Pacific salmon in every location where they occur, but that's kind of the best estimate we have. And so there are a lot of things that can interrupt that process. And so in California, the situation here is that we have a lot of hatchery origin fish. And so we've seen really massive declines in wild origin salmon over the last century here in California. A lot of that has to do with dams that have been built and have cut off a lot of historic habitat upstream of them. And that's kind of the main reason. And then there's other things too, you know, overfishing, pollution, high water temperatures, predation on juveniles. You know, there's a lot of things stacked against the salmon here. And so hatchery production, you know, fisheries managers have really relied on that to supplement population productivity for wild origin fish. And so basically we have a lot of issues with Chinook salmon straying here in California because of that sort of hatchery contribution. And so one reason is that a lot of the olfactory imprinting that occurs in early life stages gets interrupted through the hatchery production process. Mm-hmm. In some cases, hatchery origin fish, they rear them in a hatchery facility, and then they'll load them up in trucks and truck them down to like San Francisco Bay, basically, mm-hmm. and release them there. And so what happens in those cases is the whole out-migration journey where they would be imprinting on a sequence of odor cues, that's not there for them. And so when those individuals return as adults, they never had the out-migration journey to reference. Mm-hmm. So they end up straying in a lot of cases. And so,
and when they stray, they end up potentially spawning with the wild fish. Is that the issue?
Yes. Yeah, that's definitely an issue. And so there's been a lot of research.
Diminishes the adaptation for the wild fish. Is that what you're concerned about?
Yeah. Yeah. So there's been a lot of work done on that here in California. Like genetic introgression is kind of the worry. What my work is all about is looking into basically other navigation cues that individuals might be using if olfactory cues are not available to them. Okay. And so what motivated my project is this really awesome like 15-year data set on adult escapement in a couple of the rivers here in the Central Valley. And that data has shown some interesting patterns over the years of basically ratios between discharge and temperature between these two major rivers that seems to influence the fish.
It influences the route they take when they're returning up the stream.
Exactly. Yep. Okay. And so those patterns are there, but no one's ever really investigated the mechanisms behind that. And so discharge is basically flow. So, you know, discharge in a river is reported in like volume per time. So like cubic feet per mm-hmm. second or something. Mm-hmm. And so discharge is a top-down driver of more fine scale hydraulics that occur in a river channel. So if you have, you know, each river channel is unique and it has its own sort of geometry and shape to it and, you know, geological material composition and all that, all those characteristics. And so for some given discharge flowing through some given river channel, there's going to be some resultant hydraulic flow features. So velocities, depths, things like that. And so my research has looked into some optimal hydraulic conditions that might be attractive to migrating adult salmon. So basically the way I looked into this was I used what's called a Didson sonar.
Yeah. Tell me about that. That sounds like a fun toy.
Yeah, it's super cool. So the Didson, it stands for dual frequency identification sonar. And it was developed by the Navy back in 2000 or 2001 and was quickly put on the commercial market and was like immediately bought up by fisheries agencies for monitoring. It's basically, it's a sonar that works kind of like an ultrasound machine at like a obstetrician's office, but it has such a high rate of recording acoustic returns that it basically renders acoustic imagery in like a video format. So yeah, just like if you go like, you know, a pregnant person can see their baby using the acoustic ultrasound equipment. The Didson sonar basically allows you to see what's going on in a river channel.
So this is sort of a return to the Okeanos. You're instead of measuring the seafloor, you're measuring the river floor.
Yeah, definitely. So that Didson sonar allowed me to I sampled with it in a bunch of different locations based on their hydraulic characteristics. So like some deep sites, some shallow sites, some fast moving sites, slow moving sites, to basically try to understand like where these fish prefer to swim. And then using 2D hydrodynamic modeling software, I can basically create steady state flow models for a bunch of different discharge scenarios for my site, and then determine like, you know, for some given flow condition in these rivers, like where is the optimal habitat located and where is it guiding these fish?
So you had an extremely precise map basically of the stream bed, and and then you put that into a model, and then you were able to calculate what the flows would be like, turbulence.
So turbulence turbulence is like super complicated mathematically. Mm-hmm. So the flow model that our lab group uses makes some assumptions about turbulence, just because it's like it's extremely hard to model.
I think this may be apocryphal, but when Werner Heisenberg died, somebody asked him what he wanted to know or what he was going to ask God, and he said his answer was, why turbulence?
It makes sense. It's really interesting when you get into that kind of math, but it's also like will break your brain when you try to really try to wrap your head around it. But anyway, basically trying to understand like optimal hydraulic flow features for migrating salmon and how that might influence migratory routing. And so
now when you started this conversation, you mentioned though that it was a ratio between the flow and the hydraulics and the temperature.
Yeah. So part of the modeling component of this is trying to understand basically I'm modeling two rivers at once and focusing on the confluence where the two rivers meet. And so I'm modeling different flow scenarios where there are different flow ratios between the two rivers and seeing how that basically drives the spatial extent and distribution of the hydraulics.
Okay, so how much longer do you have to go in this PhD?
Pretty close to being done. It's looking like maybe February, March of next year I'll be finishing up. So
congratulations. Okay.
Yeah.
And then what happens?
I am interested in getting into environmental consulting, basically, and getting into the design and implementation of river restoration projects. So kind of continuing my work in a professional capacity. I'm actually doing some part-time work right now with a company called Kramer Fish Sciences.
Okay.
The project I'm working on is funded through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, through the CVPIA, Central Valley Project Improvement Act, which was some legislation from 1992 that basically included a bunch of provisions on how to sort of like plan and manage water operations in California, but it included some restoration provisions in there too. So that project is all about coming up with some techniques to quantify the performance of a restoration project. And so I'm taking some methods that were developed for drift foraging models. Some people might be familiar with that, which basically looks at the sort of bioenergetic energy budget for juvenile fish as they forage as a function of, you know, the velocities they're experiencing and also the food resources available to them. And so, yeah, basically I'm using an existing data set on aquatic macroinvertebrate densities in a restoration site, and using the machine learning algorithm to make predictions on invertebrate densities within the site under a range of flow conditions, and then basically coming up with like a net energy map for this restoration site to demonstrate through time how this restoration action basically contributed to production of these for these fish. So,
okay. Well, shall we move on? We're well into this now. I'll ask you my final five questions.
Sure. Sounds good.
Okay. So what is your favorite fish?
So I actually have three. Hopefully that's allowed.
I don't know.
I have a coolest fish, a funniest fish, and then a fish that has the most sentimental value to me.
Okay.
So for me, the coolest is the coelacanth, which is, as most people know, it's like this prehistoric fish that was, people had recovered fossils of it and thought it had been extinct until there was a living individual that was caught back as like 1930s, I think.
Yeah,
right. And it totally rocked the scientific community. And they're really bizarre. They have these really ancient sort of body morphologies where they have lobed fins, where they have these bony fins, which is different than like, you know, most ray-finned fish that people are familiar with. And yeah, they're just really cool, really bizarre creatures. The funniest fish to me is the mola mola.
Have you ever seen a coelacanth? Did you see one with one of the rovers that you had?
Oh, no. I've seen one in a museum, okay. A specimen in a museum, but
They observed one of those in the wild?
People have observed them in the wild. I think they occur in pretty deep water, but I've seen some footage of it. Yeah, if you Google coelacanth, you can find some cool videos of people diving and looking at those. Another weird thing about them is that their pectoral fin flap, or their swimming pattern with their pectoral fins is like staggered. So like most fish will flap their pectoral fins simultaneously, whereas the coelacanth flaps them each one individually. Yeah, it's really weird. It's like, it's almost like they're walking or something. It's very strange.
Okay.
Yeah. And then the funniest fish for me is the mola mola, which is the ocean sunfish. Mm-hmm. They're just ridiculous looking. They're just this bizarre, like, result of like evolutionary processes. You know, they're like these gigantic pelagic predators that are apparently really efficient predators because they get huge. You know, like, I think the biggest one was like 16 feet from fin tip to fin tip or something. Like, they're just massive.
Interesting. Okay.
Yep. And then the most sentimental to me is the cabazon, which is a benthic fish that lives in like rocky habitats. They're really cool. When I started diving up in Puget Sound back in 2008, it was one of the first things I saw. And they get really big too. And so I remember just being like really, I don't know, just they made an impression on me back then. And so I've always enjoyed seeing them. I've never eaten one, but apparently they're good to eat too.
Okay. What is your favorite memory from your career so far?
Yeah, we on the Okeanos, when I was running the dive unit, we were thinking about potential scenarios where we might have to dive in like adverse conditions or in under some bizarre circumstances. And so I did a lot of brainstorming with the command on my ship, and I was like, okay, you know, we're doing these proficiency dives, but maybe we should think about training for some scenario that we might encounter. And so the Okeanos operates really far offshore quite frequently. And so our dive unit, there were four of us, and none of us had ever done an actual blue water dive before. And so a blue water dive is a dive where you're in very deep water, and so the bottom is basically non-existent from a safety and operational standpoint. And so I was like, yeah, you know, it's possible that we might have a propulsion casualty, some other equipment failure where we might have to dive on the hull while we're out, you know, hundreds of miles offshore. And so there are some extra precautions you have to take when blue water diving. We had a live boat basically drop us off next to the ship, and then we had to suspend some ropes with weights for like a visual reference. Because like when you're out in blue water with no bottom and there's no like objects to orient yourself, you can get like vertigo really easily. And so that was really fun to plan for. And then doing it was just like unreal. I mean, the water below, we did this down in the Gulf of Mexico off of Key West, and the water below us was like a mile and a half deep or something. And it was, yeah, just being suspended in the water column with like infinite visibility.
Yeah. So the visibility was incredible.
Yeah. I mean, it was just like, yeah, we were far enough out that there was not much suspended particulates or anything in the water. And so, yeah, it was just, I'll never forget that moment of just feeling like I was in space or something. It was really wild.
Okay. And what is your dream job and location?
So I'm from Seattle native. Both sides of my family go back four generations in the Seattle area. And so that's really, and my wife is from the Seattle area too. So we're hoping to end up there. So I would have to say that. And then, yeah, just working in environmental consulting and designing restoration projects in rivers would be pretty ideal for me.
Okay. And so what, that segues beautifully to the next question. If money's not an issue, what's one project you'd like to work on?
Yeah, so I am really interested in this whole big data revolution that we have going on right now. You know, everyone's on social media. All of our, you know, behavior is being tracked and leveraged for like, you know, advertising and all these other things. And so I don't see why this big data revolution can't carry into the conservation world. And so if I had like an infinite budget, I think I would be really interested in installing various types of data loggers and sensors throughout, you know, watersheds to collect like really robust data sets on water flows, temperatures, dissolved oxygen, things like that, that can really help manage surface water resources.
So the Mark Zuckerberg of hydrology?
Yeah, I just finished this book. It's called Robot Proof. It was written by the president of Northeastern University. And the book talks about, you know, from his perspective, the direction that higher education is going, the direction that it needs to go in order for basically working people to survive once automation takes off. And we all need to find some way to, you know, contribute in the economy and everything. And so, I that book just really got me thinking about like my field and where I see this big data revolution fitting in with what we do. And like something that is a little unnerving to me is that we're seeing this, you know, big data movement really take off, and it's largely being driven by advertising. And what is advertising if not manipulating people? And so, you know, when you talk about like artificial intelligence and machine learning and everything, you know, people always say like, well, it depends on how we program machine learning algorithms and artificial intelligence that will dictate, you know, how it's going to behave in the future and how it will interact with us and everything. And right now I'm seeing this trend of machine learning algorithms being designed to manipulate us into buying things, which is a little unnerving to me. So I don't know. I'd like to see environmental science get caught up with the advertising world in that realm.
Yeah, it's a fascinating idea. Okay. If there was one point or principle that you wanted to have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
I think it's that it's always worth investing resources into developing new methods. So in my experience, there are a lot of environmental monitoring programs that get kind of locked into some protocol or, you know, some sampling protocol or some methodology, and then that just gets used for years and years and years, and there's no innovation being done. And so I know, like, you know, updating sampling protocols is scary and it can be expensive and things like that. But, you know, I think there needs to be, people shouldn't shy away from innovating when it comes to coming up with new methods and new ways of conducting scientific investigations. And
do you have any examples where you've done that?
Right now, the project I'm working on with Kramer Fish Sciences, we're developing a whole new way of quantifying the positive impacts that a river restoration project can have by looking at the changes in bioenergetics for juvenile fish. So up until now, basically a lot of project planning for those types of projects involves just looking at physical variables. So, you know, you design a new side channel in a river, you model some different flows through it, and you can be like, hey, you know, under these flows, like X depths, X velocities will happen, will occur at this frequency. And we know that X depth and velocity is optimal for this species we're trying to target for this restoration project. And so, but you know, the foraging and the bioenergetic component is not always there. So we're trying to revolutionize that.
Okay. That pretty much wraps it up. We've had a pretty long conversation. If people want to get more information or get a hold of you, how should they go about that?
You can find me on LinkedIn. You can also email me. My email address is smlewis@ucdavis.edu.
And it's spelled S-M-L-U-I-S.
Correct.
Okay, that sounds great. Thank you, Sean, for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was great.
Okay, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Fisheries Podcast. Remember, you can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget, you can help support the podcast on Patreon or through the Teespring store. I'm Anders Halverson. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And don't forget, you can always pioneer a new methodology.